My guest Hisham Kasim has figured out how to do things that he's not allowed to do in Egypt. He publishes Cairo Times, Egypt's only independent English-language news magazine, and he manages to get it out each week, even though it's banned from being published in Egypt. Since September of 2000, Kasim has headed the Egyptian Organization for Human Rights, a group that's only been legal in Egypt since last June. He's now visiting Washington, D.C., where he's on a panel of judges deciding on this year's recipient of the Roger Baldwin Human Rights Award given by the group Human Rights First. I asked Kasim to describe his news magazine, Cairo Times.
Cairo Times is an independent weekly news magazine. I started in 1997 with a focus on informing readers, i.e. it's not something that's catering to a political party or the government. I try and run it as independently as possible. Been in trouble with the government once in a while.
What kind of trouble have you gotten into?
Censorship or being banned from printing in Egypt. And to this day, I'm still registered abroad. I can't get a registration in Egypt, so I had to register it abroad, first in Cyprus. And then when things got tight, because there were roughly 300 publications coming out of Egyptian publications registered in Cyprus. So the Cypriot government put their foot down and made it very difficult to continue operating this way. I eventually moved my registration to Delaware.
Delaware in the United States?
The United States.
That's really funny.
Yeah, well, it was the easiest place for
me
to register.
Yeah. Why is it easier to register in Delaware of all places?
There are 52 places worldwide where you can register offshore companies. The easiest place was Delaware. But as far as I was concerned, it could have been the British Virgin Islands, the Cayman Islands, Hong Kong, uh-huh. Liechtenstein, you know, anywhere where you can register a company and operate abroad.
Since you're registered in Delaware, does that mean that you're not subjected to any press restrictions that are on the Egyptian press?
No. It's quite the contrary, because I'm considered a foreign publication. Now, that was the idea of making licensing difficult in Egypt. You're considered a foreign publication, so the government uses the pretext that you can be a threat to national security or to the morals of the nation, so you have to go through censorship. So each week, the magazine has to be cleared by a censor before it hits the market. I've been censored for all sorts of things, tackling corruption, criticism of the regime, yani tolerance on the whole is quite low.
What is the worst punishment that has been inflicted by the government either on the magazine and its ability to publish or on you or your writers, you or your reporters?
Probably the worst thing that they ever did against me was they banned me from printing in Egypt. So I'd basically prepare the magazine, take the films with me necessary for printing, fly to Cyprus, print in Cyprus, and bring in the copies with me as cargo on the plane, where they'd be seized in the airport. I can go on with stories forever. Again, the idea that I remain registered abroad as opposed to Egypt is sometimes a very painful one.
Well, now that you're licensed in Delaware, you don't have to fly to Delaware to to publish, do you?
No, you can fly almost anywhere in the world, anywhere there aren't such restrictions on printing. If you go to Cyprus, they don't ask you where your license is. They say,
right.
Show us your money.
Right.
We'll print for you.
Were you brought up with the knowledge that if you remained an independent thinker, that you would face a lot of struggles?
I guess my father was quite an influence on me in that sense, and I remember when I first started getting in trouble and being summoned by state security, my father warned me that very soon they'd try and get me to work for the regime and, turn me into a snitch, basically, and said that if I did not have the caliber or the stamina to stand up for what I believe in, then he advised me to step out rather than do something as shameful as, working for security apparatuses or for government.
Did his prophecy come true? Were you approached by the government and asked to be a snitch?
Loads of times.
How do they do it?
They sit, they tell you, you're a smart guy, there's a lot of potential for you, etc., and try and tempt you. But I guess by now they've given up.
So you know people who are snitches, who said
oh, yeah.
yes?
Oh, yeah. Loads.
And do they know you know?
Yeah. It's sometimes even embarrassing sitting with them. But I try not to get personal.
How effective are the snitches if you, and I imagine other people too, know who they are?
Well, you know, a few years ago, this respectable editor who complained to the Prime Minister, I think, saying that, you know, your snitches are the worst caliber journalists and of... and humanly as well. And the Prime Minister's reply was, do you think anybody who's respectable or of any caliber would agree to be a snitch? So I guess, that answers.
How many years has Egypt been under martial law?
Well, I mean, throughout the Mubarak regime, it's been under martial law. But it was only freed from it for about
22 years,
since 1981. But it had only been freed from it for about 5 or 6 months and then reimposed again. So that gap aside, I think it's closer to 40 years now, or maybe more.
So what does that mean in terms of daily life? What are some of the things that you cannot do because of martial law?
Well, it seriously curbs any potential for political activism. Like any meeting where there are more than 5 people, you come under the brunt of martial law. You could be arrested for that. You know, 6 people debating on politics could be considered a violation. And in many ways, martial law is becoming a law of its own, or a parallel law, or a legal reality.
Before the war in Iraq, you were a supporter of the war and thought that it might help push democracy not only in Iraq but in other countries in the Arab world. Do you still feel that way? Do you still feel confident that there will be an emerging democracy in Iraq and in other Arab countries as well?
Yes, certainly. I mean, I saw the military intervention in Iraq as a correction of American foreign policy. For years, whether the United States or Europe had supported what they call the stable regimes, which were basically our plight, or the dictatorships that vary from psychopathic, like in Iraq, or authoritarian, like in Egypt. It certainly had the impact on the region. We're beginning to see regimes opening up. They all realize that there is no future for authoritarian regimes. I saw the intervention as a way to evade a much wider intervention, because the Arab region was headed to a situation where you'd probably have 3 or 4 failed states. The demographics show that 60% of the population are under 25 and no job creation because of the lack of development. And this is because of the lack of accountability and democracy. I saw the intervention as a lesser evil, and the effect is beginning to clearly be seen there.
What effect are you seeing?
All across the region, you're seeing regimes that are becoming tolerant of dissent. Like suddenly a place like Saudi Arabia is allowing a human rights organization to be set up, a human rights conference to be held there. They're talking about elections. There's a wave of elections taking place across the region. Most of this is cosmetic. I don't see any of the regimes truly have a commitment for reform, but it's the realization that either they move in that direction or they risk the downfall of their own regime. We've seen something like the Colonel Gaddafi in Libya backtracking on his futile or silly program of weapons of mass destruction and beginning to realize that the money should be used in the development of the country rather than on ridiculous projects like that. I mean, I could go on forever about the changes happening now.
What was your reaction to the report by the former U.S. weapons inspector, David Kaye, that it looks like Iraq didn't have weapons of mass destruction any longer, that they haven't had weapons like that since, I think, 98 was the year that he gave?
Well, I mean, to me, the issue of weapons of mass destruction was something I never really bought or went along with. I didn't think Saddam had weapons of mass destruction or delivery systems. But to begin with, if that was the threat to American national security, and I'm talking from your perspective now, there is a much bigger threat to American national security, and that was to have three or four failed states, three or four Afghanistans by the oil depots of the world. And even with the correction in American foreign policy that will allow the chance for development to start taking place, I think there still will be failed states. So I guess it's an issue of that this was the pretext that the government went to war over. But in my case, my support was not over WMD. It was liberate the people of Iraq. A military intervention is something that is easy to make a decision about. Is the cost of the intervention in human life less than the regime staying? I think it is. And upon this, my support was for the intervention.
Now, you are an intellectual and a human rights activist and a publisher. I have read that there are places throughout the Middle East, and I've read specifically in that this has been true in Cairo, where a lot of people believe that there was a Jewish conspiracy behind September 11th, that all the Jews who worked in the World Trade Center were told not to show up on September 11th, because the whole thing was part of this Jewish conspiracy. I'm wondering if you come across a lot of that thinking, and as an educated person, as an intellectual, what you make of it.
No, sadly, of course, that conspiracy theory did rotate around for a while, and several other conspiracy theories just as ridiculous. This is probably the result of the total meltdown of information systems in the region, and not leaving scope for decent media to exist. It's, to me, something that could be a cause of a lifetime to help get out of this situation.
Have there been a lot of publications that have printed conspiracy theories like that, that help generate theories like that?
Yes, under authoritarian regimes, the best and brightest journalists either leave the country, and people begin to realize that to make it up in the media, you basically need to be a government sycophant. Yeah, and it reflects on the quality and the professionalism of the whole industry. And eventually you get theories like that filling the pages.
In Egypt, there were a lot of anti-war protests before the war in Iraq. Did the war activate radical sentiments or anti-American sentiments in Egypt?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, anti-Americanism is at its highest. I've never seen anything like this, because prior to that there was also the issue of the Intifada and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. However, it's not accumulative. It's not something that's building into institutions and collective bargaining over the matter. Now, if the United States can stabilize Iraq and succeed in the roadmap, which I'm optimistic about both, it will have to follow with something like a Marshall Plan for development, because the GDP of the region, there is no chance that we conduct the development on our own. And right now, I don't think Europe is going to be the necessary partner in this development, nor will Japan. And so that leaves the United States. If a Marshall Plan is introduced and it helps revitalize the economy and brings about jobs, most of the sentiment will be gone.
Well, I want to thank you very much, and I wish
My
you a
pleasure.
Good stay in the United States.
Thank you.
Hisham Kassem is president of the Egyptian Organization for Human Rights, and he publishes the English-language news magazine Cairo Times. He spoke to us from Washington, D.C., where he's on a panel of judges deciding this year's recipient of the Roger Baldwin Human Rights Award, which is given by the group Human Rights First.